Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman and the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We are on the air with we're going to be on with Matt Rothschild as soon as we possibly can. And we're testing out our Skype system here. I hope it's working fine. Matt Rothschild is the publisher of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin. Recently arrested for doing something he'll have to tell us about. Meanwhile, as we wait for Matt to come on, I'd like to talk about Fukushima. Fukushima, as I have been opening the show many, many times for the past couple of years, is getting worse and worse. We are experiencing thousands of gallons of radioactive material pouring into the ground, and we are having a worse and worse problem dealing with this situation. And we also have, as many of you know, spent fuel rods perched in the air. There are 1,300 spent fuel rods perched in the air at Fukushima. Nobody knows how to bring them down. Nobody knows how to deal with it. It is getting to be a global catastrophe. Just in the past week, the Japanese government has declared an emergency there, and has announced it's stepping in, taking over from TEPCO and the Tokyo Electric Power Company, and is going to try and solve this situation. But nobody believes that TEPCO has a solution to this, and it's a disaster. I have actually written a piece, which I'm about to put out on the internet, challenging the scientific community, the global scientific community, to come in and help out with this. I understand we have Matt Rothschild on the phone. Matt, are you there?
I sure am, Harvey. How are you?
All right, great. How are you? It's an honor to have you back on. Matt is the publisher of the Progressive magazine, publisher and editor of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, one of the great national treasures of our so-called liberal media. In fact, it's just about all of the liberal media in America. Matthew, when was the Progressive magazine founded?
Yeah, we were founded back in 1909 by Fighting Bob La Follette, the great senator from Wisconsin and one of the pioneers the progressive movement.
1909?
Yeah, we are 104 years old. We still got our teeth in our backbone, I hope.
Well, you don't look a day over 30 yourself, so congratulations on that. Tell us a bit about the Progressive magazine before we get into the gory details of your recent defiance of the law.
Well, it's great working at the Progressive because the values of the Progressive have stayed so true to what I think is moral and just. Fighting Bob La Follette himself was a huge advocate of civil rights and civil liberties. He was a dragon slayer when it came to corporate power. He resisted and opposed U.S. Entry into World War One and was vilified for doing that. And he talked about just, you know, the solution to the ills of our country was more democracy. That's what he kept saying. So he was a huge Democrat, small d. He didn't really believe in the two-party system. Ultimately, he ran for president in 1924 on the Progressive Party ticket. And, you know, he gave a critique that is so right on target today. He was a critic of corporate media, He was a critic of corporate power. He was a critic of imperialism and militarism. He was an advocate, as was his wife, Belcase Lafaud, of women's rights. The Progressive was a suffragist magazine in its first 11 years before women got the right to vote. So it's that kind of broad progressive outlook that has kept with us all these years, and it's an honor to be associated with the magazine and him and all the great writers we've had at the Progressive ever since, including people like James Baldwin or Martin Luther King used to write for the Progressive, Howard Zinn more recently.
Fantastic. And how long have you been editor of the Progressive?
So I've been editing the Progressive for 19 years now, and I've been here for 30 years.
Oh my God! Now the Progressive magazine actually published the first piece for which I ever got paid outside of the Michigan Daily and the United Press. I was a correspondent in Ann Arbor, but I wrote an article, and the editor was Morris Rubin at the time. That dates me. And then you had Irwin Knoll, and now you, right? So there have been three since the 1960s.
That's right. Yeah, Maury Rubin was the editor until about 1973, and then I worked with Irwin Knoll. People may remember him back when he was on what used to be called the McNeil Lair News Hour, and he was a critic of the first Gulf War. That takes you back, too, especially as we're getting close to another Middle East war against Syria.
Oh, God, it's amazing. And so the Progressive Magazine, how big is your circulation? You now have a website as well, right?
Oh, yeah, we've had a website forever and a day. We have about 40,000 subscribers to the print magazine, and, you know, our website gets a lot of action, too.
Well, fantastic. And you've been kind enough to publish a couple of my pieces on the website, the most recent one being about Fukushima, which I started to talk about. But let's get on a little lighter topic. I was on a debate yesterday about Fukushima with a so-called nuclear engineer. I got to tell you, I've been doing this for 40 years on nuclear power, and it's really starting to get to me. Fukushima is just so bad and so beyond anything we've encountered. You know, all these years we're told the nuclear power plants could not explode. I don't know why we ever believed them. And then Chernobyl exploded, and they say, well, that was a Soviet reactor. Now we have three General Electric design reactors in Japan, which exploded. And I have to say, I want to thank the Progressive. You actually published a piece of mine in 1976 or 77, warning about Fukushima. I was in Japan, and the people were yelling and screaming about how it was on an earthquake fault in a tsunami zone. And the Progressive was one of the very, very few American magazines that cared enough to actually publish an article about that.
Yeah, you know, the Progressive has been concerned with nuclear power and nuclear weapons, you know, since Hiroshima. And actually, for our 100th anniversary a couple years back, we went through every single issue of the Progressive that was ever published. And it was interesting. September of 1945, we published something by an author that was very critical of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then we were never taken in by the so-called peaceful atom, and that nuclear power could be the salvation of us all. So we've been critical from day one of the nuclear age, and then in the 1970s and early 1980s, under the stewardship of Irwin Knoll and Sam Day, great anti-nuclear activists, the Progressive really devoted a ton of attention to those issues.
Yeah, tremendous. And you did, you mentioned in passing, and I didn't want to let this go by, that Finding Robert La Follette opposed American entry into World War One, and that was really a major watershed in American history, because Woodrow Wilson, my least favorite president along with Andrew Jackson, used World War One as an excuse to crush the socialist left in the United States and to imprison Eugene V. Debs and destroy the IWW. And the country took a terrible right turn after its entry into World War One, which was completely gratuitous. There was no reason in the world for us to get into World War One, and of course it backfired because Americans tipped the balance toward the French and the British and wound up essentially creating the conditions under which Nazism arose in Germany. So you said that in passing, and I really hope people understand how important that opposition really was.
Yeah, and it was one of the stupidest wars of all time, one of the bloodiest, and catastrophic in its consequences, as you point out, both domestically and obviously with the rise of fascism and Nazism. And La Follette was prescient about almost all of that, and he also was prescient about, you know, the media warmongers, and he complained about the warmongers in the media constantly. and he was almost kicked out of the U.S. Senate for it. He was called a traitor. There was a move to censure him or expel him from the Senate because he was one of just a handful of senators to oppose U.S. intervention into World War One. But yeah, that was one of the most pivotal moments of the 20th century that took us in a real nasty direction.
Right, and we have now used in the same discussion the words Wisconsin and fascism. So that brings us to our current discussion and what prompted me to have you on today. I mean, I love having you on anytime, but you just got arrested. And it's an astonishing circumstance under which you got arrested. And I'd like you to tell us about it and tell us what's going on in Wisconsin now under Scott Walker.
Well, there's a counter-revolution going on here in Wisconsin. There's a counter-revolution against the progressive image of Wisconsin, against progressivism in general. What happened with Scott Walker in 2010 was elected governor, and Republicans took hold of the state Senate and the state the state assembly at the same time. And that hasn't happened for decades and decades, and they are out for blood. And so they have passed really reactionary legislation, most famously Act 10, the bill that now a law that takes away collective bargaining for almost all unionized public employees in the state of Wisconsin. But not only that, he's run through a terrible piece of legislation restricting a woman's right to abortion. He's run through a piece of legislation expanding school choice and attacking public education. He got through the legislature a bill that was literally written by one out-of-state mining company for an iron mine up in northern Wisconsin that's going to destroy the watershed near Lake Superior and devastate the Black River Indian tribes' lands. And so it's a picnic. It's a paradise for corporations right now in Wisconsin, and it's hell for those of us who believe in more progressive values. And so what's been happening every day at the Capitol since those huge rallies of February and March of 2011, when we had 100,000 people out there in the cold weather protesting against Scott Walker, is this hardy group of about 50 people has been singing freedom songs in the Capitol from 12 o'clock to 1 o'clock every workday and on Fridays outside. And within the last month, Scott Walker has decided to send in the Capitol Police, which really act like his imperial guard, and they've been arresting people by the dozen for simply singing freedom songs. And today I was there, and they manhandled a couple people, too, today. So,
well, tell us about this. What is the law that he's using as an excuse to arrest people for singing in the state capitol?
Well, there isn't a law. There was an administrative policy that he imposed that said if people gather with four or more people, they need to get a permit first from him, from his Department of Administration. And by signing that permit, you assume liability for any expenses that are incurred during that protest, whether you had anything to do with them or not. And so one protester sued, and a judge agreed that that was too restrictive, but the judge put a limit of 20, saying, well, if they're more than 20, the Walker administration can say you've got to get a permit, provisionally. It's still in the court. The judge hasn't ruled finally on it. And so the people who go to this solidarity sing-along, as it's called, they didn't want to get a permit. They don't believe that they need to have a permit to exercise their First Amendment rights under the U.S. Constitution or their rights under the Wisconsin Constitution that also guarantee freedom of speech and assembly and redress of grievances. So they are not getting a permit. And as a result, Scott Walker has brought out his armed police, and they literally are arresting people for doing nothing but singing.
Well, that's a pretty subversive activity, after all, singing. Tell me, how did the Republicans take over the state of Wisconsin?
Well, 2010 was a bad year for Democrats in general. It was a bad year in Wisconsin because our Democratic governor, Jim Doyle, was not very popular at all. And so the person who ran for his job on the Democratic ticket, Tom Barrett, who was mayor of Milwaukee, still mayor of Milwaukee, and Russ Feingold, who was U.S. Senator, both of them went down to defeat. And that's what started this reactionary tidal wave here.
Well, well, of course, we know that Wisconsin has always had some kind of a schizophrenic history. It's been a progressive state, but also produced Joe McCarthy and quite a bit of reaction. And you're still living with this. Scott Walker obviously is in the tradition of Joe McCarthy as opposed to fighting Bob La Follette.
Very much so. And we still have that split down the middle in the state. I mean, the state during presidential elections votes Democratic, and Obama got more votes than a few of the prior Democratic candidates got, but it's always been close in the national elections. And then statewide, I mean, people need to take statewide elections seriously. I think that's one of the lessons of Wisconsin, one of the lessons of Ohio, one of the lessons of Michigan, one of the lessons of North Carolina. These state elections are really crucial. And if Republicans are allowed to take over the governorship and the whole state assembly and state senate, they're going to run through some really, really reactionary policies in this day and age of the Tea Party and runaway corporate power. And so that's what's going on right here.
Well, I'm talking to you from Ohio, and we have a similar situation. And in 2012, the state of Ohio gave Barack Obama a very substantial majority and reelected a very liberal U.S. Senator, Sherrod Brown. And at the same time, the Republicans have supermajorities or close to supermajorities in both houses of the state legislature, plus a ridiculously reactionary governor, John Kasich. This is a phenomenon. We also see this in Michigan now and in Pennsylvania and in Florida, where you have extreme right-wing governors and very, very conservative legislatures in states that really aren't that right-wing.
Right, and so they're not representing the people in any kind of consensus way. There's no attempt at consensus. There's, in fact, disdain for consensus and contempt for the other side. It is really an arrogant bunch of people who are infatuated and drunk with their power. And, if that's the case, it's really, really important that people pay attention and start getting active locally. I know a lot of people, they just like to read the national news and don't care about the local news or don't know who their senators are or their representatives, but that's got to change.
Yeah, it's got to change fast. Do you see any vote fraud or any potentially not kosher activities in the vote counts in Wisconsin?
Well, there was something really unkosher that was going down in Waukesha County, which is the rich, suburban Republican county near Milwaukee, where Scott Walker is from. The county commissioner wasn't releasing the ballots until 72 hours afterwards, and she found in one crucial Supreme Court race, state Supreme Court race, she found some decisive numbers of ballots mysteriously 72 hours later that tipped the election to the Republican, and actually a Republican justice who had choked one of the other justices on the Supreme Court. He put his hands around her neck. He'd have been fired from any job in America for doing that and prosecuted for assault in many states, but here he's still on the state Supreme Court.
Oh, my God. Well, we're getting down to it. This is we're talking with Matt Rothschild, longtime buddy of mine and editor and publisher of the Progressive Magazine, a wonderful, great publication and based in Madison, Wisconsin. Matt, tell us about your own arrest now. What happened to you, and how did you wind up in the Hoosegow?
Well, this was kind of crazy. I was down covering these protests, the solidarity sing-along, as I've done many, many times. I was there with my reporter's pad, my pen, and my little iPhone to take pictures of people who were carrying the most interesting signs, and then I'd interview them and take notes. And then if the police started to arrest people, I'd take pictures of the police arresting people so I could post it on our website at progressive.org. And one of the people getting arrested that day, and this was August the 15th, she was one of the so-called raging grannies, one of these group of women, activist elderly women who sing at protests around the country, and we have a big chapter of them here in Madison. I knew the woman, Bonnie Block, friend of mine, so I took her picture, and I was following her down the hallway in the Capitol, a public place, where when all of a sudden the police said, "You can't come here." And I said, "Well, I'm Matt Rothschild, I'm with the press," and they say, "No, you can't come here." And I said, look, I've got a right to be here. I'm a member of the media. And no sooner had that escaped my mouth than they grabbed my arms, put them behind my back, slapped handcuffs on me, and said obstruction. And they took me to the basement of the Capitol where they were processing all the singers that they had arrested, and they finished with all of them, and I was there by my lonesome except with the police. And then they put me in a squad car and took me to the Dane County Jail, where I sat in a holding cell for an hour and 20 minutes with three other prisoners. So it was ridiculous. I got out on $300 bond. I've got a date in court on September 23rd. But, you know, it just, to me, it shows the hostility that Scott Walker has and these police have toward really basic American rights, basic First Amendment rights to speak, to assemble, to seek redress of grievances. And now, in my case, freedom of the press. You know, they don't like it. They don't want any part of it.
They were afraid of it.
Yeah, they're afraid of it.
I mean, you know, my thesis, and I'm going to write this up and I'll send it to you and you can decide whether you want to publish it, is that basically all this increasingly overt fascism, which is showing its ugly head in these key states in the Midwest especially, but really all over the country, comes from a corporatocracy that's afraid of the people. You know,
yeah,
you don't arrest journalists when you're secure in your support from the country.
Right, it does have the whiff of fascism, and it's a word I usually don't use because it tends to be overused. But here you have just the police power of the state being out there squashing people's democratic rights and going after union rights, which is another emblem of the fascist movement, to squash the organized labor. And today they arrested at the state capitol a former head of the Wisconsin Federation of Labor, Dave Newby, a longtime union activist, and yeah, they just put the cuffs on him because he was singing.
Are you going to sing at your arraignment or at your trial, or what's the deal? It sounds to me like Alice's Restaurant would be a good choice.
It would be a good one. I am going to invoke the First Amendment and challenge this. It's hard for me to believe that there's a judge in Dane County. I would hope there isn't a judge in all of Wisconsin who would side with Scott Walker on this. So I assume if the Justice Department or the DA has any sense that they'd throw this out. But I'm a longtime observer of politics, and when something happens that doesn't seem to make sense, I seek an alternative explanation. And so it doesn't make sense that Scott Walker is cracking down on these protesters because it's not ending the protests. Actually, the protests are 5 to 10 times as big as they were before he started arresting people. It doesn't make sense to arrest a member of the press. My hunch is that he's using it as a fundraising device, actually, to get money from his right-wing billionaires who have liked him so much and have funded him to date. I bet with every arrest, he sends out a fundraising appeal, or he gets money in the mail, because otherwise it's totally nonsensical.
Has he used your picture explicitly in any of his fundraisers?
I haven't seen it yet. He could use the mugshot, though. I looked a little bedraggled.
Well, I assume you're going to run your mugshot in the magazine.
Oh, it's not a bad idea. I did write a column for it. I haven't talked to the art director yet as to how he wants to illustrate it, but it's coming out in the next issue.
I hope you're smiling in the picture.
You know, they don't let you smile. They don't let you smile when they're taking a mugshot.
How do they prevent you from smiling?
I don't know. They say, don't smile. You can't smile. I was smiling.
Well, what if you do smile? What do they do then? They punch you?
I have no idea. I think
that should be an article about how it's illegal to smile while you're getting your picture taken in Wisconsin.
I know. I think it's absurd, too.
We're talking with Matt Rothschild, editor and publisher of The Progressive Magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, a great editor, a great magazine, a tremendous history in this country. I want to congratulate you briefly before we lose track. Wisconsin is one of the three states in the country that shut a nuclear plant this year. The Kewaunee nuclear plant went down. You still have two at Point Beach, but we'll get those hopefully soon. How is Scott Walker up for re-election?
He's up for re-election next November, and the sad truth is it looks like if it were held today, he'd win because he won the recall about 54-46, and he has still a base of support among people, and he's got scads of money. And the other thing is the Democrats have been pretty hapless in trying to find decent candidates to run against him. So it remains unclear who that candidate is. There is a multimillionaire former Secretary of Commerce named Mary Burke, who's on the school board here, who may be running, and a lot of Democrats are backing her right now, but she isn't as experienced as he is, and my I'm not going to bet against Scott Walker. I mean, he winning in Wisconsin, and actually there's even a sicker kind of possibility, and that is that there's about a 5% chance he'd become president of the United States. He wants to run for president.
Well, he's going to have to crawl over John Kasich of Ohio. I mean, we should have a lottery to see who's the bigger scumbag, but, you know, that's the way it goes. So wasn't he sort of dinged in a little sting where somebody called him and said he was one of the Koch brothers and he got all excited and drooled all over the phone?
Yeah, absolutely. He was punked by a guy named Ian Murphy, who sometimes writes for The Progressive and is the editor of the Buffalo Beast, an online publication in New York. And it was a great bit of investigative or journalism where he called up Walker and pretended to be one of the Koch brothers. And the transcript of this conversation should be assigned reading in every high school civics class, because here you had the elected governor of a state who was, as you say, was just crawling on his hands and knees to please this multi-millionaire right-winger who's a big donor to his campaign. And basically, you'd say he'd do anything in the world for this guy. And he couldn't, the imposter phone caller couldn't get Walker off the line. Walker would have stayed on the line for an hour if the impersonator had kept it going. I mean, it was that craven. It was that obsequious. It was that, the elected official is just a water boy for the corporation. That's what's happened in America. And this transcript of this phony phone call illustrates that better than anything I can think of.
It is pretty amazing, isn't it? And so Scott Walker, you think, has a chance to get reelected? Will the Republicans hold the legislature? I assume it's gerrymandered like crazy allow them to hold the legislature.
Absolutely, Harvey. They redistricted in the last couple of years to ensure their hold on power. So it's extremely likely that they will have the state assembly and the state senate, and that Walker will get reelected. So we're in for a long haul here in Wisconsin. We are used to it. I mean, we had to fight Joe McCarthy here, and it took a while to get progressivism back on the rails, and we'll succeed ultimately, but it's going to take a little while.
Well, gosh, God, this is depressing. But, you know, it's in a way, as I say, that all this repression is a sign of weakness. I mean, there are no polls that I've seen showing the American people in love with the corporatocracy here. And
it breaks. Every poll that I've seen over the last 20 years has showed that 75 to 80% of the American people think corporations have way too much power, not only over the economy, but over our political system. And so the people understand what's going on. They understand who has the power and who doesn't, and, you know, who's screwing them. And, you know, it's pretty clear to people. But the thing that isn't clear is how they should react and how we should get our power back. And one of the most important things is a campaign finance to get a constitutional amendment to say corporations aren't persons and money isn't speech, and we can regulate advertising and during political campaigns, and we got to overturn that Citizens United decision. I think that's one of the most important things we need to do.
Well, you were just at a big conference in Wisconsin, a progressive conference. What was the sense of that? Were people hopeful? And is this going to be a major focus on the left and in the Progressive magazine in the years to come?
Yeah, I think people are hopeful. People have a fighting spirit. That's what's great about this solidarity sing-along that happens every day at the Capitol. And then there was a democracy conference and also a Veterans for Peace conference here in Madison over the last few weeks, and people were gathering with great enthusiasm and a sense that we've got to, you know, move beyond Obama, that Obama's not the be-all and end-all. In fact, that there's too much continuity between Obama and Bush, especially on foreign policy, wars, and civil liberties, and that we just have to be really right out there with our progressive values and message, and talk to our neighbors who don't always agree with us, because we can't just talk to ourselves. We've got to take our politics and spread it around.
Well, we got a really steep hill to climb here. I mean, how we wound up in this position is beyond me. In this country, after all these years of activism, on the other hand, you know, it looks like marijuana is moving towards legality, which is a big deal in the civil liberties realm. I mean, we've made tremendous strides in gay rights and in women's rights. It seems like it's the best of times, the worst of times. And Matt, I'm hoping that you will not get thrown in prison for the rest of your life, and What kind of sentence are you facing for this heinous crime you committed?
You know, I haven't even looked it up. Someone said it was a year or $10,000 or something. So I better look that up and see what I'm facing.
Well, if they give you the $10,000, let me know.
All right. I'll give you a call.
All right, Matt. Thank you so much. Great to have you on, and we'll talk to you after your trial.
Thanks, Harry.
If you're still available, okay? Thanks so much. Matt Rothschild, publisher of the Progressive Magazine. Look it up. It's a great magazine online, progressive.org. And Matt, we'll be back with you as soon as we can. We're going to take a break now and talk to another editor, a web editor, Mark Carlin, from BuzzFlash. But let's hear the Solartopia song, and we'll be back in a couple minutes.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
All right, there we go. The wonderful Dana Lyons, my buddy, Cows with Guns fame. Go see cowswithguns.com, I think it is. Well over 2 million viewers now for Dana's anthem for the vegetarian movement. We're back with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We were entertained by the great Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, in the first half hour, and now we are joined by another great editor, Mark Carlin, of BuzzFlash. Mark, you with us?
Yes, I am, Harvey. Glad to be here. BuzzFlash at Truth Out. BuzzFlash.
Yeah, tell us about that. Tell us about the arrangement that you have, how this came about, and what your editorship is involved.
We had decided in 2010 that we were very similar, although BuzzFlash has somewhat of a, you might call a harder edge, a bit more sarcastic and a bit snarkier, and Truth Out is a wonderful substantive publication, tends to have longer form articles about the possibilities for a progressive future, and we thought it would be a good combination. There's so much commercialism now on the internet. When I started BuzzFlash in 2000, you could start a publication, as you know, Harvey, fairly easily. Because everyone was saying, well, the internet's great, but you can't make any money off of it. Well, now there's many publications, as we know, the Huffington Post, the Daily Beast, and on the right, the Daily Caller, that are publications that are getting a lot of financial backing. And even the print papers are converting, like the New York Times, to an internet-based monetization. So it's really important that progressive, very hardcore progressive publications like Truth Out and BuzzFlash work together.
So how many subscribers do you have? How many people tune into your BuzzFlash and Truth Out on a daily basis?
Well, there's 230,000 or 240,000 followers on Facebook of Truth Out, and then BuzzFlash has another separate one. So it's hundreds of thousands of months that come to our sites, and particularly many influence makers and activists in the Occupy movement and the anti-nuclear movement. One of the distinctive things about Truth Out and BuzzFlash that's very important to remember is that we don't take advertising. And this was one of the reasons we came together, because neither of us as separate publications took advertising ever. And so we have no corporate pressure to go along with some agenda. For instance, of course, a favorite topic of yours was that when NBC owned
General Electric
owned NBC, yes. Of course, you never saw any anti-nuclear reporting, not that you will under Comcast owning NBC. That's probably unlikely, too, just because they're so corporate. But you certainly didn't see it under General Electric in terms of the dangers of nuclear power. And this is the same problem that you have with the media in general. It's owned by corporations, usually larger holding companies that have a secondary agenda, if not to say in the least bit that, one, they own these publications or television or radio station for profit. And the way to make a profit is through advertising. So therefore, they really can't defend advertisers because they won't make a profit. So it's sort of a catch-22 in the news you see through these. The lens of what we call the corporate mainstream media is heavily influenced by a corporate perspective, simply by the very prima facie nature that in order for these companies to turn a profit, they have to have advertising. They're not going to have advertising if they insult their advertisers.
Well, I'm looking at your site, and there is indeed no advertising, so that's good. Your most recent piece came out today. Is about where's the outrage? Some lobbyists get taxpayer-funded pensions in 20 states. Tell us about the story you just posted.
Yeah, it was just posted, and obviously it's not news, but it's interesting. It only became news because the Associated Press actually did an investigative story, and their investigation was into this pattern in 20 states, which is, 40% of the United States, that some lobbyists, not all lobbyists, let's be clear about that, but some lobbyists, particularly those who represent government organizations, let's say like the Michigan Association of Counties or something of this nature, or the Municipal League for a state government, that the lobbyists will actually receive, now remember they're employed by this association to lobby state government on behalf of the association. They may represent governmental bodies, but these people receive state pensions in essence. They're private employees that receive state pensions, lobbyists, and in some cases health care. One of the big hypocrisies here is that in the cases where this happens, and let's say you are a lobbyist for the Michigan County Association or whatever it might be called. Well, in Michigan, as we know right now, there's a huge move to cut pensions, as there are in many states, public pensions. And counties are behind this, as are cities in general. There are many cities out there saying, let's keep our pensions as they are or raise them. Generally, because of the austerity meme that we have in this country, it's cut public pensions. This is what Scott Walker was all about. But really, he was the infamous sort of caricature of that because he wanted to end collective bargaining. But the reduction on pensions is a national movement that really exists in a good part of the country. And so let's say I am a lobbyist for an association of counties, and that association has as a policy a reduction in pensions, and certainly for future employees, a reduction in the amount that will be set aside for the pension funds. But I, as a lobbyist, employed by this association, not employed by the state of Michigan, not employed by a county in Michigan, I get a tax-funded pension. And I am sure that as a lobbyist, I am not lobbying to reduce my own pension.
And you would also be eligible for health care, right? Health care program.
Some of them do. Now, I think that's less widespread, but some of them are covered under the state employee health care plan. Needless to say, as is mentioned in the AP article, that there are plenty of employees who are public employees who are seeing their pensions under siege that are outraged at this. Because the lobbyists, of course, will make an exception as they lobby for cuts in pensions for their own pensions. Well, all they'll say, well, those should, my pension should be grandfathered in, something of this nature. And this is really more and more of the same of those who have in the United States and are greedy, taking advantage of those who are powerless. And that's what we try to reflect on Truth Out in Buzzflash. This was a story that just popped up today. Won't get much attention, but it should.
Yeah, right. Now, you have, on Friday, you ran a piece called "The DOJ Has Corrupted the Rule of Law by Not Prosecuting Wall Street Financial Looters." And we're now, you know, most people aren't tuned into that, but we're now facing one of the most critical decisions, one of the most critical appointments in the whole country, which is who's going to head the Federal Reserve. And there's all this talk about this horrible guy, Lawrence Summers. And, you know, who is among the financial looters. Tell us really about this whole thing about Wall Street financial looters and what's been going down over there.
Well, I think this is horrible, as I mentioned in that column, but I would say I've probably written close to 50 columns on this very subject. You know, I could get into great detail, but it would be very boring to your listeners. Suffice it to say that the
Give us some of the sexy stuff. Give us some of the really hot stuff about these guys who are stealing and not going to jail.
They said what happens is either the Securities and Exchange Commission, which can create civil settlements but cannot prosecute, only the Department of Justice could actually prosecute, they settle with them for fines. Now, they may be large fines. Recently, Bank of America, I think, paid a $500 billion fine, if you can believe it. But this comes out of the shareholders' money, not out of individual pockets of the people who were responsible for this. Much of this has to do with the predatory mortgage lending. And a lot of even progressives say, well, look, you know, nothing was proven, you know, borrowers should have been more cautious. But there have been a lot of settlements with these banks. And what happens is the banks have been allowed to plead either with the Department of Justice or the Securities and Exchange Commission. There are other regulatory agencies involved. That they are not guilty, but they'll pay the fine. I mean, you're paying billions of dollars. In many cases, only a couple million, or 4 million. But no individual has to pay these, fines for this type of activity. And, it really consists of a wide variety of fraud, basic fraud. I mean, this is fraud. It's not a question of just Glass-Steagall Act opening up and deregulating derivatives. That had a lot to do with the economic collapse in 2007 and 2008. But
and that was done by Bill Clinton as opposed to George W. Bush.
The last 2 years of the Clinton administration, Phil Graham was the lead on that. But Clinton certainly went along with it because his good pal, Mr. Rubin, who became head of Citigroup, and had been head of the Treasury, who was followed by Larry Summers, by the way, he was a big promoter in the what in essence happened, if you look at Glass-Steagall, just for listeners, because I'm sure they've heard of that, but in essence what it allowed, it had come into being in the 30s after the collapse that led to the Great Depression. And what it basically, by repealing it, allowed banks to engage in the business of what had been investment firms and financial investment and risk-taking institutions. And so you no longer had a separation between a firm that might engage in derivatives or engage in risky investments in banks. Banks basically could become full-fledged financial institutions, not banks as we knew them when we grew up. And that came about with the full support of Bill Clinton. It's sort of the repeal of Glass-Steagall has become the symbol of neoliberal economic policy along with free trade agreements. But getting back to predatory lending, what many of these banks did was, first of all, they targeted minority communities. I mean, again, these are facts. They've admitted to these. They just said, we're not guilty, but we'll pay the fine. They engage in what is called robo-foreclosures, robo-signing, where you're, an individual is supposed to review all the details before a property is foreclosed. But they literally had automatic pen signed foreclosures, and many people had actually paid up and were not subject to foreclosure, but were foreclosed anyway, and they had to go through tremendous court work and weren't necessarily compensated or didn't even know that they were fully paid up. They accepted that they had been foreclosed. They gave people incentives, employees, to lie about what they told subprime targets when they were lending to them, because one of the big problems was this balloon lending. In other words, someone may have owned a house, actually owned it, and a subprime lender came and said, well, look, we'll give you this, you'll have this cash, you know, $300,000 in cash, and you just have to pay 1.5% or 2%. But they didn't tell them that down the line, as the mortgage aged, it would balloon to 7%, 8%, 9%. And meanwhile, when the whole market collapsed, the amount of money lost, particularly among blacks, was enormous. Blacks are estimated, the black community is estimated to have lost half its net asset value as a community, the black community, in the 2007-2008 cratering of the economy.
Right, and this is not an accident, of course. The black community has been disenfranchised in many different ways, including through the Gulf War. We're talking with Mark Carlin, editor of BuzzFlash, which is at truthout.com. And one of the bigger websites, and Mark is a very aggressive and insightful investigative reporter, especially on financial issues. Mark, tell us what's at stake here with the choice of the new chairman of the Fed. This is the Federal Reserve. This is a big issue now. People actually have picked up on it. Ben Bernanke is going to resign, and Barack Obama has the ability to choose his successor, Lawrence Summer, who I will not characterize, I'll leave that up to you for the moment, is one of the primary candidates, clearly the favorite of much of the mainstream media. And there is a woman who may be more progressive that's being put forward. Can you talk about this choice a bit for us, please?
The woman is Janet Yellen. She's the vice chairwoman of the currently of the Fed, and actually also is a former Clintonite. So we're not talking about someone who's a raving, you know, radical, which to Obama is probably anyone to the right of Mitch McConnell. Larry Summers basically, along with Robert Rubin, he followed Rubin as Secretary of the Treasury under Clinton, then was head of the Council of Economic Advisers under Obama. And he and Tim Geithner kind of played a tag team with Obama, not to prosecute the banks, you know, to tell Holder not to prosecute them, to bail them out. Elizabeth Warren mocked him. I wrote a column because there was Ron Suskin, an author, wrote of an incident in 2009 at Reagan Airport where Elizabeth Warren mocked Larry Summers, and as though he were Eva Perón, and said, "Don't cry for me, Argentina," and said that, you know, his whole idea of saving the economy was just pour as much money into the banks as they asked for. That was simply his philosophy. Greg Palast, of course, who is a friend of yours and who you know, had a column last week where he received a medal from the International Monetary Fund, I believe it was, where he confirmed and authenticated it, that it was from Larry Summers, that Larry Summers was working on an international basis to free up the trading in derivatives, to deregulate it. Because if it was only deregulated in the United States, it could have presented some problems, since a lot of the derivatives Now, like many financial instruments, are international in nature. So here was a guy who was working aggressively, not just to deregulate derivatives in the United States, but internationally. He was working aggressively to repeal Glass-Steagall, who was working aggressively to give the banks anything they wanted and not prosecute them, nor try to regulate them in any serious fashion. And this is the guy that the White House has made it clear through, I wouldn't even call them leaks, through kind of openly talking to the Washington Post in particular, just that people are not giving their names, but they're openly talking and saying that the White House is leaning heavily toward Larry Summers and Obama is. And there was an interesting article in the Washington Post last week, which I thought was sort of sexist, that necessarily from the Post perspective, but from the White House, basically saying, well, the people in the White House, the economic team, felt more comfortable with Larry Summers. He was more of a team player. And yet they could state nothing about Janet Yellen, who would indicate that she would not be a good Fed chair. And yet Larry Summers is the kind of guy that exemplifies, if you just look at it from a practical, pragmatic, economic perspective, the kind of guy that doesn't seem to learn from failure. In fact,
he seems to succeed from failure. And the key issue here, Mark Carlin, editor of BuzzFlash, is what's going to happen with interest rates. I mean, you know, the economy has been somewhat in recovery, I think the number one reason is that interest rates have been held very low by the Fed and in Bernanke and the Federal Reserve. Now, in a modern economy like this, rich people like high interest rates because they have lots of money. And if they have money and they get high interest rates, they get a big return. They don't like low interest rates, but people who have to work, who are trying to buy houses and pay mortgages, people and buy food, people on the bottom do like low interest rates. And I think in this case, what we're talking about here is Larry Summers would come in very clearly in my mind and do what Alan Greenspan did and others and just raise interest rates. Nobody seems to be talking about this definitive piece of the puzzle.
Ben Bernanke has been teasing that he's going to raise interest rates for about a year now. And if I had to speculate, I would say we're close to that moment. But then again, he's been saying it for years, so it's purely speculation on my part.
Well, I will guarantee you if they raise interest rates that the economy will take a giant plunge. And if I was a Republican, I would be lobbying like crazy to get interest rates raised because the economy will tank and Obama will become extremely unpopular and the Republicans will have a big leg up in 2016.
Well, we also have to understand that we have two economies. You know, I wrote you may not know, but I did write a column some time ago called The Tale of Two Economies. And the mainstream media likes to talk about one economy, and they like to use the Fed's interest rates, the amount of factory production, and the jobless rate as the key indicators for that economy, that one economy. But we have two economies. Right now, the rich have become even richer. I mean, since 2007, 2008, the stock market has been running at or near record highs the past year, year and a half. And the people who are in the 1% are getting, if they were wealthy, now they are luxuriously plutocratic. I mean, they beyond their wildest dreams, the economy has improved for them. They are making so much money that the billionaires list is climbing, each of the people by billions each year. because their assets are increasing so much because of the stock market rise.
Right. And even, Mark, we're down to the last 2 minutes here. Even with a Barack Obama, an alleged progressive in the White House, there doesn't seem to have been any abatement in the transfer of wealth from the rest of us to the rich. It seems to be going this trend that started very clearly during the Vietnam War of the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer has actually accelerated under Obama. Is that correct?
It's accelerated. It's going to get worse because if you look at the fine print at the return, Harry, of the new jobs, let me quickly tie two things together. Many of these new jobs are at, people are returning to the marketplace, but they're returning at minimum wage or far below what they were making before.
Yeah, I'm looking at Mark, we're going to have to pretty much leave it at that. You're a great guest. I'm going to have you back. I want to discuss this in greater detail. When do we expect a decision on Lawrence Summer or the head, new head of the Fed?
I think the White House has been holding off because it's trying to see. It's in trouble with progressives and with the Republicans. And it's losing its support in the white base.
Okay.
I think they're holding off.
Let's talk about that again. Something people haven't thought about, this choice of the head of the Fed. If there's anything to lobby on in Washington, that's a big one. Mark Carlin, editor of BuzzFlash at truthout.com, your great guest, Mark. Your latest column is on pensions being given to private lobbyists. Who'd have thunk that one? And thank you for occasionally publishing my pieces as well. This has been another hour of the Soratopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you so much, all you great engineers at PRN. And we will be back next week. Mark, I'll have you back on.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. And I'll be posting this on the web. And we want to thank you all for joining us here at the Soratopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We will see you next week for another hour of brilliant talk. Thank you so much.
It's going to be a hunky-dory, but now we know it's going to be a green-powered earth, and that'll be Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.